After I had been practicing analysis for 50 years, I asked myself, what was the most important thing I had learned in those 50 years? And I thought the most important thing that I had learned, it takes me a hard time, a lot of work to learn the obvious, is that the patient is somebody else.
Welcome to the IPA podcast. For those of you who have been listeners to the past 40 episodes of this podcast series, you know that we've been focusing on analysts who bring their clinical skills to venues outside of the consulting room, hence the name psychoanalysis on and off the couch. Given that we are all facing together a crisis of unfathomable proportions, we're going to be changing the focus of our podcast. We are going to be interviewing psychoanalysts from all corners of the globe to discuss with them how their local communities are coping with this situation, how their clinical work has been affected by this situation, and also how the internal worlds of both the analyst and the patient have been impacted by this virus, as it impacts both our real fears and our imaginary fears. We're going to encounter not only uncertainty and fear, but we're also going to learn great wisdom, gifted empathy, and hope. We'll be maintaining the title of this podcast, both as a testament to our past work and as a placeholder for our future work. I hope you find these conversations both informative and sustaining. Feel free to write comments on our webpage, IPAoffthecouch.org. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Warren Poland. Dr. Poland is a psychoanalyst in private practice in Washington, D.C. He is a former editor of the JAPA Review of Books, and he has been on the board of the Psychoanalytic Quarterly, he estimates, for about 40 years, and he's been on 8 other peer-reviewed analytic journal boards. Dr. Poland was awarded the Sigourney Prize in 2009 and the JAPA Journal Prize in 2002. In addition to many, many articles, Dr. Poland has written 2 books. The first was Melting the Darkness, The Dyad and Principles of Clinical Practice, and the more recent work is Intimacy and Separateness in Psychoanalysis. For those who treasure beautiful writing, do yourself a favor and read Intimacy and Separateness in Psychoanalysis. There aren't many writers who can work right on the edge of poetry, of philosophy, of clinical medicine, of psychoanalysis, and wise living. All those elements are gracefully presented in this work, such that you really will read paragraphs over and over again because they're both elegant without being too precious. It's really special. I recommend it. In addition to those books, for 5 years, Dr. Poland also wrote a regular column called The Clinician's Corner in American Imago. I hope you enjoy this interview as much as I enjoyed conducting it with Warren. We cover a lot of territory. He shares what it means to him to be vulnerable in this time. He shares his sense of responsibility to others, the centrality of the recognition of the other. And with that recognition comes aspects of responsiveness, the separateness between people, and how his goal is to appreciate the patient as another. And as he and I discussed, with that is the parallel goal of helping the patient recognize his separateness. He reveals himself to be really a man of the ages with great literary interests and references that are just a treat to hear. If I were to sum up what I learned about Warren in this conversation, and there's no reason to sum it up, but it's something I tend to do. My experience of him is really of both deeply kind and deeply erudite. And for me, that is a very special combination. And I hope you enjoyed as much as I did. With great pleasure, here's my conversation with Dr. Warren Poland. Warren, welcome to the podcast. It's so nice to have you with us. It's a pleasure I've been looking forward to for some time. Warren, when someone comes to us for analysis, they will often come in crisis. And it seems to me that we have two tasks in the face of that. The first is to be with them in the crisis, in whatever form it exists for them, in whatever fashion that they experience it, and to be present with them. Your felicitous term is to witness. And while we're doing that, simultaneous to that, and perhaps uniquely analytically, there's a part of our mind that is also considering the history of this person, that we are curious about what we learn about their past as they recount their present, what it is about the current crisis, what it is about their reaction to the current crisis that is informed by their history. So we're in more than one place at one time. And it seems to me, that we as a people, as humans, are now in a crisis. We are all struggling in this very odd pandemic situation. And I thought you would be a very valuable and helpful person for us to speak with, for me to speak with, for our listeners to hear. Because of your seniority, in age, because of your seniority over the many decades that you've practiced analysis, to reflect for us and with us on what this crisis seems like to you, including how you're practicing, how you're feeling, and also, in addition to that, to walk us through your personal history of being an analyst and how that history has evolved over the decades and where you are now, how you look at your work with your current eyes. That's a broad invitation, intentionally so. Let's start by talking about how things are for you right now.
I thank you, and your summary of the analytic process is very touching, with the key phrase that is to the heart of it all, your phrase, with them. We are there in the service of the other. The fact is, it's a hard thing to be a person. It seems easy, but it's never quite right. In terms of myself right now, I simultaneously am shamelessly terrified and yet insistently optimistic. The question you posed reminded me of a lovely line by Cynthia Ozick that I would paraphrase, in which she said, "We all struggle to live to the fullness of life, to live the fullness of life to the trembling rim of the fragile human cup." Freud said that civilization started the first time a caveman threw an insult instead of a rock. Well, civilization got very threatened when other packs of cavemen started throwing lots of rocks. That got tamed, but there are forever crises, over and over, gunpowder, airplanes with bombs dropped on cities. If you think of Guernica and what it captures, the Cold War, the nuclear bomb, and now we have this terrifying pandemic that has me afraid to leave my house, and behind it, a Cold War, a climate catastrophe, so that there are constant crises, any of one of which very well may be the end of our species. There is no reason to think we're the end of evolution. And yet, we have children to take care of. We have a future to protect. We have patients to take care of. But life is terrifying for our species. I don't know any other way that it can be. And it breaks my heart because I come from a tradition where people died early, and now I have lived to see a great-grandchild. Will that great-grandchild be able to live to my age? All we can do is hope for the future and work for it. You know, I'm reminded, talking to you, several years ago after 9/11, Evi Schwaber gave a paper at the American I was asked to discuss. It had to do with her terror about 9/11. She had terrible personal involvement, family involvement with the Holocaust. And she posed the question, how could she get up and go into the office and see patients? But she did. I thought it was the easiest question she posed. Of course she could do that because her patients needed her. Our children need us. The future needs us. That's all we have. And thank God people did it for us before. We have no choice but to do the same.
The future needs us. That's something to ponder and to take with us. Walk us through your history. Tell us about your analytic journey. What you just condensed is really the product of decades to be able to focus on the other, and that the other then needs us. And in relation to the other, we have a responsibility and a desire to be responsive to them. They may sound like careless sentences, but I know they're not from you, and that they encapsulate a life's work, which you so beautifully describe. And we will get back to this in your latest book, Intimacy and Separateness in Psychoanalysis. I cannot recommend it enough to our listeners. The book is an elaboration of a rich three-dimensional elaboration of that notion of the other and their existence, our recognition of it, and our responsiveness to it, and theirs to ours, and how that's a real encapsulation of the analytic process. But it took you decades to get there, and we're lucky enough to be able to read your book. Can you share your journey with us?
I'm lucky enough still to be here. Many decades ago, long before I had an analytic self, someone asked me to write a paper on self-analysis. So I went back recently to look to see what I said. What I said, being as honest as I could with myself, was that while I had all the idiosyncratic yet traditional conflicts and psychosexual developmental issues of everyone, the more I looked at myself, the more I realized that the greatest single struggle I've always had is that of trying to figure out what it's like to be somebody else. After I had been practicing analysis for 50 years, I asked myself, what was the most important thing I had learned in those 50 years? And I thought the most important thing that I had learned, it takes me a hard time, a lot of work to learn the obvious, is that the patient is somebody else. He's not the patient as patient. He's himself and really other character in the scene of his life. So I started to go back and look at what it was like in my career with your question. Since I started my apprenticeship, which was when I started as a candidate in the Institute, I was not one of those people who read Freud's book on dreams in kindergarten and was dedicated to be an analyst. I was trying to figure out what the hell it was all about. And in my training, what I was trying to figure out is what I was supposed to do. What is an analyst supposed to do? But it dawned on me after a while that you can't decide what technique is unless you decide what it is you're trying to get done. And that no one seemed to have said clearly. There were lots of partway answers for me, making the unconscious conscious, where it was this or ego B, turning ghosts into ancestors, as Lowell so beautifully put it. But they were still too abstract for me. What are you trying to do? The best I could come up with over time for myself, and which I shared with patients, was my sense that at the end of an analysis, the end of the formal part of the analysis, a patient should be able to go down a dark alley without being afraid to meet himself. I couldn't quite get it quite right altogether until I just I guess working it through elsewhere in my life also, had an experience when my wife and I went to Florence. There we were looking at the phenomenal, beautiful art, the gorgeous sculptures in marble by Michelangelo, the Pietà, the David, the slaves, all of the others. When in a large room with many large pieces, I noticed over on the side a very small dark one. I went up to it. Oddly enough, though it's well known and considered the high point of realism in Renaissance art, I had never heard of it. And I also did not then know that my reaction was actually a very well-known common reaction. To me, it all was new. But I looked at this little piece. There was a wood carving, old darkened wood, of a woman, life-size, small, about 5 feet tall, who looked called penitent, but bereft, heartbroken, in such agony and pain with loss that I started to get tears in my eyes even as I think about it. I was magnetized by it. I started to look at it. I lost a sense of time. I don't know whether it was 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes. I don't know. And then, overwhelmed, close to depersonalized by the power of the piece, and knowing it had been carved by Donatello more than 500 years ago, I had a tremendous urge to shout out, "There's a real person in there." I was stunned by it. Later, I was trying to figure out what happens in an analysis. And it struck me, that's the whole point. Two people come together, one a so-called professional, but not knowing about how the wise way to live life is. In fact, I think the worst occupational hazard any analyst can have is the fantasy that he or she can live the patient's life better than the patient can. And the reason I cherish neutrality is not because we can be totally neutral, but because we really have to remember we're there in the service of the patient. So a patient comes, called a patient, with some problem of living, and it's our task, in my view, to remember this is somebody with a real person in him or her, struggling, uncertain, ambivalent, never quite settled, complex, lots of different points of view. It is not somebody who is there as a patient with diagnostic categories, with fancy formulations. Anytime I'm with the patient and I start formulating consciously, I know something has gone off that has me backing away from the patient and not truly engaged with the patient at that particular moment. And Caleb and Wineshaw years ago wrote a paper on technique that I loved for the model. It compared it to what the analyst and patient are doing to Sherlock Holmes. Analysis has a lot in common with other therapies, but the core that distinguishes it from all the other theories and therapies is that it adds the search for what, as I define psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysis is the disciplined study of whatever it is the patient does not want to know about himself. So the analyst is struggling with the patient to help the patient find himself. And going back to Caleb and Wineshaw, it's important, vital to remember, the patient is Sherlock Holmes. The analyst isn't. Theory is by definition wrong because it comes from accumulation of lots of data, and everybody is unique, specific, and particular. We need the theory. I've written a lot. I'm not know-nothing. I'm not against knowledge. It tells us questions to ask we wouldn't know to think about or to ask. But any case that demonstrates, whether it's ego psychology or self-psychology or Klein or Bion or whoever is of the fashionable theory of the day, is simply untrue to whatever is unique about that patient. Things should always be something new and fresh because it's the patient's life and we're in the patient, in the help of the patient, learning to have the courage to ask himself or herself, by the way, I know I skipped to my own theories here, but the longer I've gone, I think as long as the analyst is honest, truthful, with trying to search on that level, ruthlessly, honestly, and stupidly, meaning without having had the answers, then what really matters is that the patient picks up that the analyst has gone through the same sort of thing. And the patient is not without empathy. The patient reads us even better than we read the patient, despite the transferential constrictions. And it's the analyst's self-analysis that is silent going on in the back of the minds, but revealed in its effect, that is what's mutative and powerful for the patient. I hope I haven't gotten so circular because so many doors open in so many directions.
I understand. Let me go back to something you said before about your discovery after all these years of the centrality of the patient is someone else. Would you not agree that that's also the patient's analytic journey is to discover at the end of analysis that you, the analyst, is someone else? And maybe not even at the end, but along the way. And the otherness of the analyst allows the patient to discover their desires, their hopes, their disappointments, their longings, their imaginings about the other. Would that not be a central part of an analytic process in your view?
It's at the heart of the night. Thank you for stating it in a way I had not so succinctly, so aptly, so beautifully. Absolutely. Yes. The whole problem is that each person is an individual, unique, separate, and apart, and yet nobody exists outside the fabric of the human interchange. But two strangers come together, they get intimately involved, and both change, both or neither.
Sure.
Both change, one privately, I hope, and one publicly between the two, but then they go apart. They may have tender feelings, they may be emotionally engaged, but they are separate people. And that's where the politics of the situation in analytic practice often leads to splits between the absolutists of different sides. I think your point is the central thematic point. I absolutely am in accord with that.
Let me read a couple of sentences from your book that I underlined and folded the page down and have returned to since it's late in the book. And you say, an analyst's honest regard is what I believe ultimately matters most in an analysis. It is the personal and professional derivative of the love that is at the center of Eros, that which allows one to go on despite the imperishability of Thanatos and the inevitability of individual death. And you close the paragraph by adding, such regard, rooted in one's recognition for another, is weakened when altered into inspiration. One of the themes that I gleaned from your book is you have a keen eye, sensitive to people's self-aggrandizement. And maybe this is also what you mean.
That's myself. That's why.
Well, I mean, and here I am, a podcast interviewer. We all do our things, you know, that have self-aggrandizing qualities. But you're very careful to separate out the regard and the attention to the other, and the smile as we stand in front of our mental mirror, admiring ourselves. And that's an important point that you make.
I thank you. I share a moment in personal involvement. I was a kid, new to presenting. I never thought I'd be on panels. I'm thrilled with the good fortune I've had. But I was added to a panel on neutrality 100 years ago as the young'un. And I was very pleased. That was on a Saturday morning at a meeting at the American. That evening, my wife and I, on a high floor in that dreadful hotel, were coming down the elevator all the way down to go out for dinner when on got another couple, a senior analyst who was world famous and instantly recognizable, and his wife. There's no reason for them to have known who I was, though I certainly knew who they were. But there we were, four of us staring forward towards the elevator door, when the famous analyst's wife turned to me and said, "Dr. Poland, you said something at the panel this morning that I don't agree with." It sort of surprised me, but I asked her what it was. She said, "You called the analyst the patient's hired hand." Well, when I'm talking at the panel, just as when I'm talking with you now, I don't remember what it was that I said, and I didn't recognize having said that. But I thought about it. It sounded good to me. I was kind of pleased that I had thought to say such a thing. So I asked her, "What is it about that you don't agree with?" She said, "Well, you may be your patient's hired hand, but my husband is nobody's hired hand." And I turned to look at him, thinking he would look embarrassed. But he clearly felt proud to be championed. Such, how have the mighty fallen?
It's a commentary on the nature of fame, I suspect, right?
Of people who seek fame.
Yeah, sure. And one of the comments is that they may have wives behind them for whom it is very important.
Yes. In any case, I understand. I have patients whom I don't charge any fee to. Patients who are paying a high fee, but in the crisis, I brought up the subject. They couldn't afford to pay for it anymore. They've suddenly lost everything. Hmm. And I brought up the subject to them because they were just letting the bills accumulate without mentioning it. And I knew they felt dreadfully ashamed receiving my bill each time was traumatic. So I simply said, "This is not the reality. We always negotiate what's appropriate. It seems to me the appropriate fee right now is zero. And when you have an income again, then we can renegotiate the fee."
It's the first time I've heard that mentioned in all the conversations and online discussions about this crisis we're in. That's the first time I've heard someone mention how they've dealt with patients who are struggling with change in financial situations.
I could not do that when I was a candidate and a supervisor said, "Why don't you lower your fee?" And I was worrying about paying my rent every month with children. But this is a different time in my life. I feel very strongly, I'm sorry if it wanders, indignant, furious about people who say that analysts exploit patients by keeping them too long. Analysts tend to be neurotic, but they do not tend to be knaves. The fact is that all of my very long cases are money losses to me at token fees where I turn away patients who would pay multiples of what they're paying. Not because I'm good, but because when you say you're going to sign up on a ship, you sign up, whether it's a storm or calm waters, and as long as you can, as long as it's workable.
Like you said, the future needs us and our patients need us, and you're responsible.
We need to be needed, not just for our own narcissism, but because we're all individuals, we have to touch each other for human warmth. The reason I mentioned the fee is because I think it's important that the patient have the power to fire a doctor. Since we're wandering a bit, I'd like to mention two things from my favorite supervisor, who was the most useful to me and the least known of all. I was desperate for cases. So when I had an analytic case, he took me on to start supervising it. And after the initial crisis passed, he said to me, "You know, I know you want an analytic case, but this person came to you in crisis. And he would have agreed to anything you suggested that would have made him feel better. Analysis is a big thing. Now that he's not in crisis, I think you owe it to him to open up the question of whether he wants to proceed with this kind of work or shift to something else, so he's doing it by choice, not by habit or intimidation." I think that was very dear.
And provides plenty of material for analytic investigation, too, the meaning of choice and the meaning of freedom for that person in that dyad. It's a lovely example.
Of course, the other was, because I'm articulate and talk a lot as well as often fairly well, when I was a candidate, I started to get lots of referrals. I got my analytic caseload filled quickly, even from teachers. But what I noticed, and I had to know this, was that I had patients referred to me for analysis who would come for a few months and they all quit, which is not the way it's supposed to go. Now it's very easy to see. I was so urgently trying to be an analyst, so urgently trying to analyze, so urgently trying to justify myself that I flooded them, not with where they were, but with trying to prove I had something of use to them. In any case, they quit. So I turned to him and said, what do I do? He took me seriously. He gave it serious thought. And he gave me the best advice I've ever had and the best short discussion of interpretation I've ever had. He said, you want your patients to come back. I'll tell you what you do. Tell them something they can use, and then they'll want to come back for more. You're the patient's hired hand. Help the patient work it out and recognize that it's the patient's life and you never have it right. You only help get closer to it so that the patient can start to see things that perhaps he could or she couldn't see before. You know, I appreciate you for helping me figure out my own thoughts.
Whether you get it right or almost right or wrong, the patient will sense that you're trying. That you're trying to understand them and give them something that can be useful in their life.
But it has to be truthful. I can think of things from my own second analysis, the training analysis, which fortunately my work with the candidate as a control case helped me survive, where it became clear that getting the interpretation in and feeling better whether it fit or didn't fit seemed to be that analyst's theory. I think it had... Dumb and honest are the two main characteristics.
You know, you say so much in your sort of seemingly throwaway lines. We could spend a great deal of time talking. Your comment that your work with your first analysis when you were a control case for a candidate helped you survive your training analysis. I mean, this is not the forum, I guess, to go into great detail about that, but that's a tragic vignette.
It's not a criticism of the training analysis system. I'm not speaking about the
No, policy. I wasn't commenting on the system at all. I was commenting just on your situation. To have to survive analysis is not what this is designed to be.
Oh, I think I know more about my training analyst life than he knows about mine.
Right. And so many of us have had to have more than one analysis for a host of circumstances for another time. Yeah. Let me ask you, your seniority, you've been around a while. And in our earlier conversation, you shared with me, you're coming around to conversation in the fullness of conversation, which obviously also includes the issue of people being separate from each other. Hence, the conversation is between separate people. Tell us more about that.
I was so touched by your invitation to have this conversation with you. I'm kind of surprised, but over the last couple years, and especially over the last couple months, I've had requests to present papers, to teach courses locally and elsewhere by internet, and I don't do it anymore. I'm not opposed to it. I've moved into what, for better or worse, and I wish I were younger, I speak of as my post-reputation phase. I've spoken to a number of my aged colleagues who consider retirement, and they don't retire in part because they want the conversations. In an office, you have the kind, in an analytic office, you have the kind of honest conversations that we all long for and tend not to have elsewhere in life. Yes. I have the feeling that they are possible still elsewhere in life. And to my thrill, and totally unexpectedly, over the last decade, I've developed a small handful of friends, some of whom I've never even met, or maybe just once in passing, who are epistolary friends in Europe, South America, Canada, and here. They're just a few with whom we correspond in open, honest conversation, a lot about writing, very, very little about analysis, more about families, about what it is to be. I think in going back to the opening about the crisis we're in, and actually much more pessimistic than I like to admit to myself, but heartbroken at the world I am afraid I'm going to be leaving behind, having been born in the year that Franklin Roosevelt first was in office, the New Deal, the progress, seeing it all reversed now. It's condensed Germany in the 30s and even worse. Yet I have the feeling that intimacy, one by one, personal conversations of the sort you and I are having at the moment, that's where new growth is. That's what matters. Freud said that the voice of reason is strong, but it will not rest until it gains a hearing. I'm not sure it will always gain the hearing that makes a difference. But I think what is human and what is humane is regard for the other. I consider psychoanalysis the clinical lab of philosophy. What does it mean to be a person? What's it like to live as a person among other people? How does one get along in life? Not the academic, that there are others. But I mention that because I have learned recently of Levinas, a post-Heideggerian,
yes,
who deals with the word of regard, the recognition of the other, the line of self-development of an individual self, and regard for the other are not two separate lines of development. They are different facets of the singular, intrinsic, innate, single line. And person-to-person caring, little bits of touching respect, whether it's with a clerk in the grocery store or with one's dearest friend talking about heartache, whatever it is, the intimacy of what rings true and is shameless, not afraid to show vulnerability. I started with one of my favorite quotes, and I know we're getting ready to end. Let me end with one of my favorite quotes, not Cynthia Ozick, but Anne Morrow Lindbergh, the woman with the fascist husband.
Right. That's quite a person to choose. I'm interested in the quote.
Well, she, as you know, the horror of having had her, because of fame, her infant, yes, child kidnapped and then discovered murdered. The extreme worst heartbreak. It's unimaginable. In a letter to her mother after that, she wrote the sentence, "I am trying to protect my vulnerability." The willingness to be vulnerable, the perfectionism being the enemy of it all, the having the answer, the knowing the theory. I don't know, but how can we figure something out? Then the game's afoot and life's afoot, and conversation is at the heart of it. My own private useful theory, raised as an ego psychologist in formal training with a lot of Sullivanian and relational influence, melding the two together.
Warren, my temptation is to...
I will stop.
No, my temptation is not to want to stop you at all, but to want to find a core of this conversation.
Yes.
And to share a personal aspect. You talked about the acts of kindness, the acts of sincere generosity. You and I have spent some time putting this conversation together and planning on it. And in all of our encounters, I have found a great pleasure in getting to know you, in receiving your kindness and receiving your generosity. And so I'm saying this both to thank you for it and to honor the authenticity of what you're saying, that you don't just say it, you actually live it. And it's been a pleasure and a privilege for me to share this conversation with you, not just from the content which is precious and deserves careful listening from all those, and I'm sure there will be many who will listen to this, meeting the needs of the future, taking care of our children, recognizing the patient as an other and helping the patient recognize us as another. These are little gems for us, but your kind regard is that which I will take personally from this.
Well, I have to thank you by saying I can accept what you say and trust to it, because at the core of conversation, at the core of vulnerability, is the realization of reciprocity. And I feel so much the same in getting to talk with you and getting to know you, that I can accept that it must be parallel and true. I do thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.